Welcome to Shadows from the Tree, the podcast that invites you to explore the curious world of dark genealogy, uncovering secrets, scandals, crimes, and darker events that shape family trees. Whether you're a seasoned genealogist just beginning to explore your family history, a history buff, or even a crime junkie, we offer something for everyone. Join us, your hosts, Danielle and Michelle, in each episode as we share stories from over a century ago for the first time with each other, centered around dark genealogy themes. By using newspaper archives as our guide and conducting research using historical records, we piece together these often forgotten stories and gain a deeper understanding of the challenges those involved faced. Our hopes is to connect you, our listeners, with your ancestors' past, one story at a time. So here we are.
Yeah, welcome back.
Yep, season 2, episode 3.
Yep.
Yeah, and I dragged you into this one this week. I had found this article while just searching about what we could do for different themes, and I found Rebellion, and I said, hey, can we please do this one? And then I'm curious to see what you found.
Yeah. It took a while for me.
I was gonna say, yeah. There was a lot of bigger rebellions, especially if you think about like wartime.
Yeah,
I found a lot of those.
Civil War, women's suffrage. I was like trying to stay away from the bigger ones and find like a smaller community rebellion. But we'll see. I can't wait to hear about yours first.
Yeah, perfect. So So I'm gonna go. We chose the dark genealogy theme of rebellion, as we mentioned, and mine did, however, tie to a war. And I like history. War's not usually my, like, what I'm drawn to. Yeah. But so I apologize if anyone's listening who's like a, you know, history buff in war. But I think I fact checked my facts that I'm going to share. So my story around rebellion was called the Green Corn Rebellion of August 2nd, 1917, which happened in Oklahoma. It was also nicknamed the Draft Rebellion. And so if people are living in Oklahoma, I'm assuming they probably heard about this, hopefully, because it's their state's history. But it was such a short-lived rebellion that I'm sure maybe people of our generation's couple detached maybe wouldn't know. And I certainly hadn't heard about it. And my husband, who studied history, I asked him. He didn't know about it. So
cool.
So, yeah, hopefully we can share it and connect some families. So basically, it was farmers, African-Americans, Native Americans, and members of the Socialist Party, which was really strong in Oklahoma back then. And they had planned to march from the farm of Joe and John Spears in Saskawa at Roasting Ear Ridge. And they were going to march to Washington, D.C. to protest the draft in hopes of abolishing it and ending the war, right? Oh, sounds cool. Great.
That's so funny. I asked my son, like, what I should do for rebellion, because he's studying, you know, U.S. history, and he gave me a name, and it was someone who was going against the draft.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so funny. Oh, I'm going to pick his brain after. So this drew me in a little bit, but we'll get to the part that really was like, okay, I have to do this story. So they do the draft. I think farmers, you know, were in it because why take our boys from our land? They're going to end in poverty. Yeah. Like, you know, we have the Native Americans, that's their land.
Farm needs,
And then obviously the socialists. So the draft bill was signed into law May 18, 1917, and it called for all eligible young men all over the nation to register the draft on June 5th, 1917. So just a couple months before their rebellion. And they, from what I can tell, they named it the Green Corn Rebellion because they plan to pick the green corn, which is coming around during the summer, to pick it and store it so that they could eat it, like roast it, I guess is how you would eat the green corn, and use it along their journey as they pass through different farms to get to Washington. So that was going to be like their source of food. And basically, it shortly ended. Literally like a day after, August 3rd, 1917, after only a couple hours really in it. And there were lots of people arrested, and this kind of took place along the banks of the South Canadian River. And there was reports that there had been 3 killed. One name mentioned was Clifford Clark, who was a farmer. And then it says like 450 people were detained, 266 of whom were released without charges. And then the others were actually convicted, most of them pleading guilty. And some of the prison terms for this very short-lived rebellion, these people spent 60 days to 10 years was the time frame it mentioned.
10 years?
Yeah, I think that went towards like the leaders,
so
right,
of
the pack.
Them? Was it like local
government? It was local government and just like the officers of the state, like the people in the state. So I guess they were given a lot of praise for how quickly they turned it around. I read one article that the people of Oklahoma at the time almost considered it like embarrassing because it just didn't go, you know.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was a big like talk of the town and you know, we were going to do this and then it didn't go anywhere really, but I still think it proved a point. It got noted in history. So this is where I shift a little bit and I decided to focus on one family just because it kind of came to me like that. And keep in mind, I'm only focusing on one family, but if there were, you know, 800 people in total who participated and then a lot of them got, you know, taken away, then other families experienced the same type of thing, I can imagine. So the family I'm doing is the Reeder family. And going back just a little bit, the head of the family, I should say, Walter M. Reeder. He was the one who joined this rebellion. And he was born March 11, 1881 in Texas. And he soon, you know, as he got older, when he was 23, he married Etta Mae Cummings. And he was 23, she was 24, and they both got married in Carter, Oklahoma. And they end up having three kids together. So they had Don M. Reeder. He was the firstborn around 1906 in Oklahoma. Then there was Thurmond Debs Reeder. And he was the second child, born February 6, 1907 in Oklahoma. But he actually died November 2nd, 1911. So he was only 4 years old when he died. It doesn't say, I couldn't find a record of what, but on his grave, he's buried in Lone Grove Cemetery in Oklahoma. It says, "How much of light, how much of joy is buried with our darling boy."
Oh,
I know. So sad. So you can see both of them on the 1910 census. They're living with the mom and dad. The dad is a driller for oil wells at the time. And then just before or after he dies, we actually see Walter. There's a newspaper article that shows the whole ballot in 1907, and he's actually running on the socialist ticket as a constable. So we see him there. So you can tell he's not in it because he's a farmer. He's probably just really more towards the whole movement of it, right? So that's the second child who dies. And then right after that, the third child is born in 1912 in Oklahoma. And her name is Albertine, which I love. I just,
cute.
So cute, right? I don't know what a nickname would be, but it's
Birdie.
Cute. Could be. That'd be cute.
Right?
That'd be cute. So they have their little girl. And that's kind of where we loop back into what happened here with the rebellion. So what I can tell is they had this rebellion end of the summer, right, 1917. In 1918, around June or July, he actually gets arrested by Charles Jones and brought to jail. He's indicted by the grand jury in the federal court for the Western District of Oklahoma and charged with 6 to 7 others with conspiracy growing out of the resistance to the draft by the Socialists and the IWW, which was the Industrial Workers of the World. So, and then I also see that he, there was an article saying he got originally tipped off by other people that he was being, you know, someone was coming after him. So he kind of like hid away, and then they had a Constable Jones outside of his house, and he tried to sneak in, I guess, one night, and that's when he got caught. And then at some point he gets fixed on $5,000 bail, which of that time is, you know,
substantial.
Yeah. So So that happened. So he's going through it with the Corps and being arrested and in jail. And then we go to October 3rd, 1918, and he, I think they might have tried the court again. He's convicted with six men on all three conspiracy charges and the grand jury indictment. It was Cumbie, Reeder, Harris, Clark, Bryant, and Stewart. And it was 6 years in federal prison and $3,000 fine each was the penalty that was fixed by Judge Neblett. And again, it's convicted on charges of conspiracy to defeat the government's war program. So he was sentenced to, I guess this is where I will bring in one of my resources, shall we say.
Nice.
So, you know, what do I like to do on Ancestry?
Pictures,
but I like to try connecting with people.
Oh, yes. That's true.
So I find someone who has information and, you know, of this family in their trees, and I just send a friendly little message and just say, hey, just looking for more information, because, you know, like, we really want to hear what has been passed down over time about these stories, right? Like,
the oral history,
yeah,
families, and the family lore, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So I just was trying to find out, like, what she knew. And so she was, so her dad was Walter M. Reeder, was her dad's great uncle. And she was just kind of researching the family. And due to the nature of Walter's crime, which she discovered, I think, when she was just researching old newspapers for obituaries and found an ad that was sort of related to one of Reeder's brother. And then she kind of just went down a journey from there, researching his name and then finding out about this. And she was actually able to, like, kudos to her, she could pay a small fee with, I believe, one of the states and get the records released to her. So she got prison records, fingerprints, mug shots, like, she got a package. And let me just show you the picture here. And this all correlates with what I have records of, like, his indictment date and his prison number.
Oh, wow. He's got some nice hair.
It actually is quite nice. So that was him. And she had also said that she was told by one of the dad's cousins that back in the day, people would start coming around later on and, like, asking about it. And, like, people would get mad. They just didn't really want a part of the conversation and the connection with the Socialist Party at the time. So, yeah, she did a really nice job. And then she also had asked some cousins if they had heard anything about this, like, this history in their family, and some had not really. And so she just said her interest is really the secrets that are usually kept in families, which drove her to, like, investigate further into Walter. So kudos to you. We're in it with you because that's what we also like to do. So he gets tried. And then he's incarcerated on November 26, 1918 at Leavenworth, Kansas. He has inmate number 13341. And then we had that nice photo there. So he's over there. He's going through it. There was also, she had some information regarding, like, a bail and being out during a certain time frame on the bail during this whole process, which would make sense because his name was listed on the 1920 census, so that must have been, like, a time that he was actually home on bail. Mm-hmm. But this is where, okay, you ready for where it drew me in? So I'm researching his name, and then I get an article about these children crusaders. Okay, so the first one shows up on March 1922. There are 20 children crusaders who plan to go to assemble in St. Louis and then go in a body, as it says, to Washington to ask President Harding to restore to them their fathers who are now in prison as wartime politic offenders, asking that they can be released and freed for crimes that were strictly political. And now that war has closed, they didn't, you know, they needed their fathers back.
Right.
So little Albertine gets quoted in there. Her name was actually the one who was most mentioned in the articles as almost like I want to say the leader of this crusade, but
go Birdie.
Yeah, I know. Love that. So, and she's at this time like is only like 9.
Oh wow!
So she's little.
Little and activist. I love it.
Yeah, I know. So that's why I was like, ooh, I wonder what she did with her life, right? Like off the bat, the questions are rolling in. Yeah. So in the article, you know, for an example, we talked about like this is only one story of the families that dealt with this. There was a story of 2 children who were also going to go on this march because they were trying to beg that their father be released because their mother had died while he was in prison. So now they, you know, they didn't have a family. So just sad. And so when I'm searching, I found a picture. I was so excited. The first copy I found was like very dark, right? And I can't really see. So I just kept on searching different the same article in different newspapers. And each one I found got like lighter and lighter.
Nice.
but it's still quite far away. So you can't really get a good close face glimpse. But the article is titled Children Picket White House. And if you can see, that's Albertine and her mom. And then I believe, does it give the name of the other people? Miss Bentley. So there they are. And there's the children standing outside the White House.
Very cool.
And I think, does this one say, there is somewhere in the article where it says what their signs were kind of saying. But I did a quick little history on the President Harding at the time. I think he was very popular when he sat. I think he died in office. And I read something about kind of during his last bit of time, he did let go some of these prisoners of politics. Right. But I wasn't able to dig too much more with the time frame we had. So there she is. She's being a little advocate. She's, you know, trying to get her dad back. But then on the other hand, like, that's a lot for a 9-year-old, right? She already doesn't have her dad at home. It's been a couple years on and off.
She's in a different area with her mom, yeah, right? And all these other children.
Yeah. So I know. It was just interesting to see, like, and then I'm just picturing, like, these children, like, walking down the road, you know, just.
Yeah.
It was interesting. So. She goes, and let's see here. The head of this expedition was someone by the name of Miss Kate Richard O'Hare. And supposedly they were hoping to take recruiters on, like, as they stopped at each state. They were going to stop in Chicago, Indianapolis, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Marin, Detroit, Buffalo, New York, Philadelphia, and Baltimore.
Wow.
Was the plan. And obviously they seem to make it with that picture.
Mm-hmm.
And they describe Albertine as bobbed hair, brown eyes, with her thin legs and shabby shoes, how she approached and was going to go talk to the president, and quoted to say that she needed him very badly in a certain little cottage back home in Wilson. And another quote, please, Mr. President, give me back my daddy.
Aww.
I know. Sad. So that's kind of where my story kind of stops in a sense. So Walter ends up getting out, and it was undecisive whether this was the same time frame that the President Harding kind of released people. Mm-hmm. But I found a document which was interesting. It was actually his registration card for the draft. So I had said that they needed to register for the draft by a certain date, right? That was the I say the 17th, I think. Oh, yeah, 1917. So the date on his draft that he actually signed was September 12, 1918.
Wow.
So he must have really not chosen to register. And then what was even more interesting was in the notes for this, it says, just out of jail, the IWW not working. So I'm assuming this is when he's kind of in between bail and court hearings, but then he must have been like, oh, I better go sign up for the draft.
Right. So don't end up back in prison.
Yeah. So just to conclude a little bit, we have Walter ends up passing away July 27, 1924 at the age of 43. So he's only just like out of his imprisonment, right? The daughter at that time, Albertine, was only 11 and the son was 18. He's buried in the Lone Grove Cemetery. And I couldn't find much you know, just because the 1920, there wasn't much after that since he passed. But he's got a nice headstone in Lone Grove. It's big. It's got him and his wife there. And what I could tell is that he got in an accident. So there was a couple of small newspaper clippings from the Wilson, Oklahoma, where he got in an accident and wasn't expected to live. But then he was like kind of recovering a little bit. But then on his obituary, it says that he was in an accident with the oil rig. So I don't know, maybe the accident with the vehicle was actually while he was working. It was kind of hard to read. So unfortunate that happened, but you search his name and, you know, this is the kind of stuff that came up for him. Don, the son, first of all, you have Don, right? You have the second son, Thurmond. And then you have Albertine. I'm like, why did Don just get like a, you know, like the other names are so unique. I'd just be curious. I couldn't find much on him actually afterwards. I tried searching. So if you're out there listening and you're somehow tied, that'd be great to hear more. Albertine goes to like college. She goes to study English and gets her bachelor's in that. And then at some point I read that she's a librarian. So into history and literacy, and here's a picture of her in college.
Very cool.
Yep, so that's her in college. Very pretty. And then I found a couple here's her childhood one. So that would be a little bit closer to maybe how she looked when her father passed. Yeah, it was 1926, so 2 years after. And then I even found like her wedding announcement. Again, the picture's like so dark because it's scanned. But, you know, so I found some good stuff. So she got married. She had children. She did die youngish. And let's see, in 1978, at the age of 66, which is a bit of a shame. But and then her mom, let's go back up to her really quick. Her mom also buried in Lone Grove in 1957. And then just little bits and pieces that I found. I found like a newspaper clipping saying that Don and Albertine were given like the estate, I believe, of Walter, 1925. So probably after he passed, it went into their name. So nothing, my story wasn't too crazy, but I just felt really drawn to that little girl. I don't know. It was just, can you imagine? It's, there's a lot,
right,
to process, to see like what she already saw in 9 years of life.
Yeah. She traveled a lot. She met a lot of people, I'm sure, and heard a lot of stories that were similar to hers or,
So that's what I got. The Green Corn Rebellion.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, good story.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, so my story is also based on rebellion. We are going to talk about William Sidney Hatfield.
Oh, okay.
Smiling Sid.
Ooh, okay. Catchy nickname.
Well, he was born, so Hatfield, right? What do you think of instantly? The Hatfields.
A hat maker? I don't know.
The Hatfields and the McCoys, you know, that big family feud and like the
McCoy sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Oh, wait.
It was like the battle of the families in like the Appalachians.
Okay.
So he is descended of, he's like,
oh, cool,
in that family, but he wasn't directly involved in that particular feud, but okay, you know, he's got it in his blood to have a little little fight rebellion to him, you know. So he, William Sidney Hatfield, he was born May 15th, 1891 in Ransom, Kentucky. His father Jacob was 45 and his mother Rebecca was 34. So he ended up moving to Blackberry, Kentucky, and he had, you know, a lot of siblings. He was one of 12, and it said, I think, 9 or 10 of them survived past,
That's,
like, infancy. So he
had
a good
statistic.
A big, big family.
Wow.
Right? So that's something to note. He was, you know, very, very much a man of the Appalachian Mountains. So he ended up becoming a police chief, but he was destined for a life of kind of that violence
and a little edge,
kind of like edge to him, right? So he was in West Virginia in early 1900s, where, you know, what is the main thing they're doing? They're coal mining, right?
Okay,
that's the industry. So coal was king, and companies that owned the mines ruled with an iron fist. So they didn't want the workers unionizing, so they actually would hire these detective agencies to go in and like squash any kind of like worker rebellion, or they'd hear of people starting to congregate and say they wanted more rights, better pay. Like a lot of these coal mining owners like would literally own the whole town. They would they would like fund the churches and the shops, and like people wouldn't actually own their houses. They would
rent to the,
they would just live in the like
the dwellings of
so they're more like indentured servants and slaves than actual workers, if you think about it, because they're basically owned. Everything they own is not there. So it's a terrible time for people in these,
and it's hard work too, right? It's not even like it's it's easier.
It's long days in a dark cave
area.
Like, think about that. 10 to 12 hour days in coal. Like, that's just, and you're breathing that in. It is literally
claustrophobia. Terrible. I mean, the whole thing. Yeah.
Terrible. So it was, yeah, like we said, brutal. Long hours, dangerous, inadequate pay. So there's this constant threat of being fired too, or blacklisted, where, you know, you would no longer have a job. So then where do you take your family? Like, you're literally like tied to this for your life. So the tensions were, you know, getting laid for this conflict, and that's a big part of his life. So he wasn't your typical lawman. So they actually called him like double gun. He always had two handguns on him. And the
just in case.
And the reason why he was called Smiling Sid was because he literally had like gold teeth. There's actually like, he actually did a reenactment like movie video of one of the, I'll talk about, it's called the Massacre, the Madwan Massacre. So it was rebellion in action, right? But he actually did a movie, and there's actually like a clip of him smiling
with his teeth.
I'll show you the clip later, but it was the coolest thing to see. Like, you never see them come to life.
Yeah,
right?
Like, exactly.
I've never had a person.
Only in your own mind.
Yeah, yeah. So there's pictures, of course, but then I saw this clip of him that it's like a black and white, you know, no sound, but he's like smiling, and you can see, like, that's crazy. And he has kind of like, like pronounced ears, and and in the descriptions of him, he's not very tall, he's kind of like thin and short, but he had that air to him of the like Hatfield
name. He definitely had a vibe.
So his defining moment came May 19th, 1920. So, it's, like I said, it's that Matwan Massacre. So, it started when the Baldwin Phelps Detective Agency, so it's owned by these two men. So, William Baldwin, sounds familiar, right? And I think his name was Thomas Phelps. And it was a private security force hired by the coal companies. They were coming into town to evict miners who had joined the newly formed United Mine Workers Union. So, they were like, you're done. So they were literally ripping people out of their homes and into the streets. So these detectives were notorious for their brutality. But that day they met with some resistance. So
I wonder from who.
So led by Sid Hatfield, a group of local miners and townspeople confronted the Baldwin Phelps agents. The confrontation escalated quickly, and a gunfight broke out in the streets. But when the smoke cleared, 10 men were dead, and including 7 of the Baldwin Phelps agents. So it was one of the brothers of, like, it was either Baldwin's brother or Phelps' brother. I think it was Phelps' brother who was killed. So they were like, you're in trouble, Sid.
Someone's coming for you.
So he emerged as a local hero, of course, to the miners and their families, because, you know, usually they don't have anyone supporting them. It's like them against the coal miners and their brutal force. So he had done something almost unthinkable. He stood up to them and their private army and won. For many, he stood as a symbol of hope, because he was willing to put his life on the line for them. And
well, he had the double pistols. I mean,
yeah, he really went
came prepared.
For it. Wow. So let me, I'm just going to read a clip here. So there's lots of, he even had an article all the way in the New York Times, because he was like, you know,
it made that
national,
big of news.
National news.
I wonder if he was like, I'm not saying arrogant about it, but like, if everyone's calling a hero, was he kind of like, neutral about it, or was he like, you know, lavishing in it a little bit?
No, there was like a big to do about it. So this one was to come in December of that year. So it's still, they're still talking about it 6 months later. So a 6 month labor war in Mingo Culinaries in on unionization. So a strike and disorder followed discharge of men attempting to organize. So they had to send 500 troops to restore the area. Like, it was literally chaos.
Wow.
So there were miners way back in March began to organize. So they declared, like, the owners did not want that happening at all. So let me just get back to where it was talking about Sid.
I would definitely like to see what he, I need to see that clip of him.
Yeah. So the fire occurred in the open street in front of the Norfolk and Western station a few minutes before the arrival of a train, which the private detectives were to board and go to their homes in West Virginia after their day spent dispossessioning the striking miners and occupying the house owned by the mining company. From all accounts, they acted without warrants and without the 30-day notice provided by for the law. The evictions of the strikers, who now were with their wives and little children, living in tents pitched in the bleak mountainsides in the immediate vicinity of the mines, has added fuel to the flaming bitterness with already excited and 11 deaths. Oh, they say 11 in this article.
Wow.
Were the direct result of the flare-ups. So the murder of Anse Hatfield, a hotel proprietor of Matwan, followed the indictment of Sid Hatfield and other 22 for their alleged share in the shooting of the 11. So that crew, the detective agencies, was literally just going in and, like, anyone with that kind of, like, relation to him was just, it was like revenge and vengeance, and it was not.
Would they have to act with the higher up authority, though, those detectives? They kind of just seemed like they just were their own people.
Think about who's paying them, the coal miners, and who owns the law back then, like the railroad owners, and I'm just thinking about like J.P. Morgan and like all those big names who just basically owned the world and ruled the world. Like, you're gonna go against them. What are you gonna do?
Yeah,
think about it. Who's gonna go against Elon Musk? Like, really?
Right?
You know,
right.
Like,
that's exactly
not happening.
Especially back then, they didn't have much at all in general.
Yep. So after the massacre, so he became a hero. He was part of, there were several trials that followed, and he was charged with murder, but he was acquitted because, you know, but much to the outrage of the coal operator. So he was actually let go.
Wow.
Yep. The victory, however, was not super long.
Oh no, he died.
Well, we'll get there.
Oh, no.
So he continued to support the miners, speaking out against the coal companies and standing, you know, as a symbol of defiance. But that made him
a target.
He was a marked man. So on August 1st, 1921, just over a year after the Matwan massacre, Sid Hatfield and his friend Ed Chambers, so they were, you know, the local lawmen of this area, they traveled to McDowell County to stand trial for an unrelated charge, but as they ascended the courthouse steps, Baldwin Felt's agents ambushed them. Both men were shot dead in broad daylight.
Ooh.
Yep. I forgot to mention something that happened, though. So one of his, like, during the original massacre, the mayor of the town was also killed in this shootout.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the mayor of Matwan. And him and Sid had made a pact that if something happened to him, his name was, I think it was Testerman. If something happened to him, he wanted Sid to take care of his wife and his son.
Really?
Yeah. So there were a lot of articles kind of saying, like, oh, Sid killed him so that he could marry his wife.
Oh, gosh.
And there's, like, pictures of her. The widow marries her husband's murderer. But really, it was.
He probably was like, I need a strong person who I know will take care of my.
Yeah. So he married her a couple months after. So it made her a widow again when Sid was killed.
By the same people. Both her husbands were.
Yeah. So
wait, so he wasn't married when he
first
did this rebellion.
No.
Okay.
No. Nope. So he wasn't married. Oh, that's interesting. And then he took her as his wife so that he could protect her. But then, like, he also. So there's actually accounts of them, like, the wives of the two men of Sid and his friend Ed, who got shot at the courthouse. Like, they say that their wives were there when it happened.
Oh, and they watched.
Yeah. So it was really.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Not great at all. So.
It's hard. That's hard.
Yeah. Ed Chambers, his wife, like, there was our talk of her. She was, like, trying to get in the middle of it, and they were, like, pulling her away from him. Yeah. So. So the assassinations of Hatfield and Chambers were a stark reminder of the power of the coal companies held over life and death in that region. Mm-hmm. And yet his death wasn't the end. It actually, in fact, sparked what became the largest armed uprising in the U.S. history since the Civil War.
Wow.
The Battle of Blair Mountain. So thousands of miners took arms against the coal companies in a full-scale rebellion. Although it was eventually crushed by federal troops, the fight for labor rights in the coal fields continued, with his legacy looming large in the movement. So there was a picture of his funeral. Guess how many people were at his funeral?
I'm hoping all of them. Like, all the
3,000 people.
Wow.
Were at his funeral. That's how, like,
wow, how
much
well
of a difference
looked after
he made in people's lives. I was like, but where were they to protect him, though?
I know.
Like, 3,000 people. Like,
wow.
I don't know. Maybe he just...
It's sad, but it is, like, one of those historical events, right? Both of our stories really, right, like, highlights the struggle of the working class individuals, really, yeah, of that time period.
Yep.
And although these smaller... Well, yours was bigger. But, like, the actions may have not seemed like it made a difference, right?
Yeah.
At the beginning, but they did.
No, they did.
Small.
They sparked. They, like, light the fire
exactly
in other people. And they're like, well, we're not being treated right. You're right. So he was just willing, even though he wasn't one of them, he was willing to be, like, kind of their support system, mm-hmm, when no one else would kind of stand up for them. Which
and that's,
really
and that's
cool.
Brave, right? Obviously, that's really brave.
Yeah, his life was short. He was only about 30 years old when he died. Yeah. Violent, tragic, but he left, like we said, that mark for the fight for labor rights. He wasn't a perfect man.
Yeah.
There's
yeah
a lot of times yeah there was, you know, accounts of him being a bit of a hothead. Others, he even said he was reluctant to be a hero, but that it made him stand out when he had that willingness to defy the system. It's still relevant today, so it's actually, like, part of the national parks is, like, the monument. His gravestone has, like, actually, like, carved image of him.
Oh, no way. Show me.
Yeah, I'll show you. Hold on.
And it's one of those things, like, I think we had used this as, like, a team meeting starter once. Like, what would you want your legacy to be, right? And I think this is a pure case of him. Wow.
So they etched it right into.
Right, like he's had a legacy now, and he will always be remembered for that.
And on his headstone, defender of the rights of the working people, gunned down by Felt's detectives on the steps of the McDowell County Courthouse in Welch, West Virginia, during the Great Mine Wars.
Wow.
And on the bottom it says, we will never forget. His murder triggered the Miners' Rebellion at the title of the Blair Mountain. So.
Wow. Was there a lot of, like, news? Oh,
that's the picture of everyone at his funeral.
Look at that picture,
right? Yep.
Oh,
that's
wow.
He's in a casket, and there's just his wife.
Oh, you know, I love this,
and, like, all the people there. So,
wow, you got some good photos,
right? I like, the more I dug, the more I realized, like, oh, this is a big story. So this is him.
Wow. Look at his pistol.
Right? There's another one. See, this is his double gun right here.
Oh, my gosh. I'll definitely be posting
these. That's Ed Chambers, the other one who was gunned down with him.
He looks a little older, but maybe it's from conditions of the mind, right? Conditions of his work.
Mrs. Sid Hatfield.
Oh,
so that's
okay.
He married after the, you know.
Great photos.
Yep. So this and this. Caption, it says, Mrs. Sid Hatfield, wife of Chief of Police Sid of Matwan, under indictment for killing Albert Phelps, so that was the brother of who owned that detective agency, in the street battle last May, is said by many to be the prettiest woman in Mingo County. She was the widow of Mayor Testerman, shot after Testerman's death It is said that this was his dying wish of the mayor. Mrs. Hatfield accompanied her husband to court at Williamston and was the center of attraction in the crowded courtroom during the preliminary hearings of the Hatfields case. So she was supporting him when he was on trial. Like, they were even saying, like, he might have murdered her husband, but, like, no.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yep. So we have lots of pictures here.
Yeah, I'll definitely be posting those on the social media. And I think, the photos, they're just... People are very lucky when you find photos, because if you have your own family history and family trees and you don't have those, it's, the image really helps.
Yep. So, awesome. That was a really, really good one. So next time you hear about labor struggles or corporate overreach or community standing up. So I just kind of think of him and what he did. He took on those big names, and like, you might not have had that long life, but he really did make a big impact. Difference.
Amazing. Well done. I feel like that was a good story given the topic, and we both had slightly different, kind of the same working class, but slightly different. So
very good. Awesome. Well, thanks for joining.
Thank you.
And
remember, it's not a matter of if you will find a shadow in your family tree, but when, because behind every family tree, there are shadows.